For the record, we just say Cornell. I actually was calling up alumni to ask for donations, and they say, I don't want to give to any Weill Medical College. I went to Cornell, so it's a bit of a stickler issue, so we'll all absolutely forgive you for that. So today, if this presentation seems very, very familiar, is echoing the prior three excellent presentations, I think it's really reassuring and incredible for me to be here and hear that there are others in LA and San Diego and Houston doing very similar work, albeit with different programs that have a different structure. And effectively, you know, what we've already said, to parrot it again, you know, kids need to be able to see to reach their academic achievement. They need to be able to see to get around and to achieve everything that they can in life, and that's why all of us are working so hard to try and correct those vision errors as early as possible so that they can have a chance to, you know, reach their academic achievement. I have no disclosures whatsoever. If anyone wants to give me some disclosures, I'm always welcome to, you know, see me after. This slide, I think, should be self-evident at this point, just to parrot everything that everyone has said. Vision is fundamental, absolutely fundamental to learning, especially in school-aged children, and I think I see, looking around the room, many people like myself wearing glasses, and I'm a high myope, if you can't tell, a -9, and so I can't see my nose without the glasses, and could not imagine having been able to get through school and college and medical school without the aid of glasses and contacts and the number of vision professionals that have helped me over the years. And, you know, like many people as well, that was picked up when I was 5 prior to starting kindergarten. My parents took me to my pediatrician, and I failed a vision test, and that led to a number of things being triggered. And that is often how it happens. But for many, many kids who don't have resources, don't necessarily have access to a diligent pediatrician or even a pediatrician at all. They may have two parents who both work. Many of the children that we see, and I'll talk about a little bit later, live in and out of the shelter system in New York City. They're in public school, and that may be their only access to a healthcare provider. That may be their only access to a hot meal for the day, breakfast and lunch, before they go back to a family shelter. And that affects at any given time. The numbers are down now, but as many as 50,000 families in New York City, which is an unbelievable number if you think about it. And so for the kids without those advantages, without access to health care, it can be such a huge detriment, as we've heard all morning long, again, to parent everybody. And correcting the vision is just so fundamental early. And as we mentioned, again, cost of glasses, limited access to vision care may really be insurmountable barriers. To go to Lens Crafters or Cohen's Optical and shell out $65 for a children's pair of glasses, if you want the cool Ray-Bans, it might be $125. That's an insurmountable obstacle for some people. To take the time off to bring the child to the ophthalmologist, to the optometrist, to the optical shop may be an insurmountable obstacle. And like many of the others here, we hope that our program helps to alleviate that strain and helps to provide adequate vision for as many children as possible. So I'm very, very proud to be representing the CREST Vision Program. CREST was founded in 1988 in New York City with an endowment. The CREST family donated quite a lot of money specifically at that time for correction of preventable vision loss. Specifically glaucoma and cataracts, and then over the years we've branched out into school screenings as well. You can see here, this is Barry Skolnick, our optometrist, performing a screening in a van, and we find ourselves in soup kitchens. We were once screening within the walk-in fridge at a soup kitchen in Bed-Stuy, and we set up wherever we're needed. We get calls from community organizations, churches, schools, libraries, and so as we've branched out, we're not specifically focused on schools, but we do provide screening services in a large number of charter schools as well as New York City public schools. And I think just to clarify, some of the other presenters spoke about they have a primary screening by the school nurses and then they're referred into their program for the final screening and refraction. We have kind of a mix. In some of the charter schools, we're the primary screen. We're going through all of the children, identifying those who fail a vision screen, and then providing further testing. And in the public schools, we're the secondary screen. So we kind of fit in both molds, and ultimately we provide an optometrist, a refraction, full vision screening, and then we provide for and pay for ophthalmologist referrals where needed. So all of that happens at the school's request. They submit a form to us and demonstrate need. And we don't have quite an RV. We have a little Toyota RAV4, but we drive anywhere throughout New York City, and we have a very, very enviable parking sticker that lets us park anywhere. Those of you who have driven in New York, alternate side is something special. Anyway, as you can see, we go really throughout the five boroughs, even Staten Island, although it's not shown on this map, and I can just, you know, highlight, you can see the overlay, the darker colors. I don't know that this projects very well, but the darkest blue indicates that 40% of persons in that zip code are living below the poverty line. And for a family of four, that's only $23,000. In New York City, $23,000 a year hardly gets you a studio apartment. And so these are people really, really strained. And to have 40% or more of persons in that community living at that level, to then say, spend $100 on glasses, put out an outlay for children's insurance, we can talk about it a little bit later. These are real financial strains. And you can see it overlays very, very nicely. The areas that we go to are directly in the communities that are calling for us and have demonstrated a need. I can think specifically back to, you know, in the South Bronx, we went to MS 123, a school that has the highest population of homeless students. So they are not sleeping on the streets. They live in the shelter system, but almost 80% of students in that school live within the shelter system. They move very frequently. Their parents are often out during the day either looking for work or working menial jobs. And you can imagine in that situation, it's so difficult to then put an additional burden on the family to say, go get glasses or any real health care for dental care or primary care. It's difficult for them. And we go directly to these communities, directly to the schools, set up and provide a screening. And just really, when I was putting together this map, it just of all the places that I've gone to over 6 months, it was just very striking to see the overlay and how it really does match up with this index of poverty. So for this study, when we go into a screening, we have a form and the children fill out basically, you know, their age, whether they've had glasses before, whether they lost or broke their glasses, and basic demographics, and then we fill out the part of what were their eye exam results. Were they 20/40? Were they 20/100? How did they do? Did they pass a vision screen? Do they have appropriate convergence inductions, their eye muscle movements? Are they having a lazy eye? And then we look at whether they were referred, whether we gave them glasses, and we put all of that into a large Excel spreadsheet and ran it through statistical software. So we looked specifically at a six-month period from January to June of 2013, and over that period of time, we screened 17 schools for a total of 569 students, and we get the full gamut of school-aged children from 5 in kindergarten to 18, and slightly more than half were male, but a little bit less than half were female, 267 females, 302 males. So a very representative school-age population that we screen throughout the city at elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools. And the results were striking. Again, we fit this niche as kind of sometimes we're the primary screen and sometimes we're the secondary screen, so our results may be a little bit more biased toward seeing the kids who have already failed a vision screen. But nearly 60% of the kids we saw had initial visual acuity worse than 20/40. That's whether or not they were wearing glasses. We put them in front of the eye chart. They're at 20/40, which in most states means you can't get a license. That their vision is so poor that they're not able to drive a car, and we're expecting them to navigate the streets, to see a board, to read. And you know, that's really not an acceptable level of vision. And even worse, you know, nearly 20% had vision that's 2100. For reference, when you go into the eye doctors and you see the big E is about, you know, 2400, the next line down is probably 2100 or 2200. And so this is a real visual disability. I think these kids probably are walking, bumping into the lockers. It's astounding that they're getting around. It's probably how bad I would be if I were to take off my glasses and try and go to school in the morning. Might get there, but with a few more bruises. And striking, a lot of these kids had been told that they had refractive errors. They'd been told that they needed glasses. They'd even been prescribed glasses. But at the time of screening, a mere 5% of them actually had the glasses and were wearing them consistently. And those 5% feed back into the larger number that don't have an accurate vision correction. If you got a pair of glasses in second grade and now you're in sixth, they may not fit, you may not have them, and they certainly aren't doing an adequate job. And this was a statistic that was true to my heart. I probably went through maybe 20 or 30 pairs of glasses over the course of my primary schooling. And, you know, that happens. Children break glasses. And about 35% of them reported that they had lost or broken their glasses. And this was corroborated by the teachers. They say, you know, we sent them to Crest Vision last year. They got their glasses and they were wearing them for 2 weeks. And then, you know, something happened. And, you know, kids will be kids. And so that's a striking statistic. But a large number as well had never been screened, had never been prescribed glasses before, about 60% of them. And again, very personal to me, boys will be boys. This may surprise I don't know if anyone finds this surprising. Boys were about 2.5 times as likely to break or lose their glasses. And, you know, sexual parity, be it what it may, at least in our study sample, this was highly statistically significant, and boys were very much more likely to break or lose their glasses. Again, my own personal history, I needed to get rec specs, those like giant plastic polycarbonate ones, because it was too many pairs of broken glasses after the Toms River Basketball Association games, and my mom just said, enough, you're wearing the ugly ones, and that was it. So broke those anyway. All told, of 569 children screened, about 71% of them got glasses. So we have an optician that comes with us in our little RAV4. We have a set of trial lenses, and just to echo Judy's experience, it's so fun to watch them picking out their frames, and they really you know, find one that fits them and makes them happy, and then we make them in about 2 weeks, send them back to the schools, and go. Our optician goes and makes sure that they fit and are functional for the kids to use. And for most of the children, we're able to provide two sets of glasses to try and combat these issues of glasses being broken and being lost. And I think that's a really important idea to take home, that one pair of glasses just may not be enough for active children. And then, again, speaking that this was a group that had been screened in, they'd failed a primary screening, we have a high percent who had to be referred for follow-up exams. 61 or about 10% of kids were referred primarily because at the time of refraction we couldn't get their vision correction to be adequate. Oftentimes that's due to amblyopia, meaning, you know, you have a 7 or 8 year old child who has a lazy eye, and that eye has the brain has ignored the vision in that eye, and so sometimes it's too late to correct that, but we urgently refer them to ophthalmologists, usually the same day or the next day, to get seen and get into treatment and try and correct their amblyopia before it becomes a permanent vision loss. And so that's done actually back at Weill Cornell, and our ophthalmology department sees them free of charge for the Crest patients. So those were by far and away the most common causes, were either, you know, a visible ocular motor defect where, you know, they're deviating and they weren't using one eye to see, or just, you know, you're refracting and the left eye is like 20/200 and you just can't get it better. Those were the kids we referred for further ophthalmologic care. So in conclusion, in our study population, uncorrected refractive errors were extremely common. Again, if you lump together the 71% we gave glasses and the 10%, that's, you know, nearly 80% of the students ultimately had an uncorrected refractive error. And as we've mentioned all morning long, children's vision needs are especially sensitive to economic pressures. On the totem of family priorities, getting the child glasses comes somewhere after shelter, food, clothes, warmth. You know, you may have other siblings with other needs. Mom and dad may need insulin for their diabetes. There are other host of needs that, for better or worse, surpass the child's need for glasses, and you can understand that. They're also highly likely to break or lose that sole pair of glasses. And kids grow. Our eyes grow, and you need frequent exams, either annual or biannual, to update the glasses as they grow, and it's just hard for families to keep up with that expense and to keep up with that time commitment. So In New York City, we do have affordable health insurance available to all children, theoretically. Child Health Plus should cover all of the students that we see and should provide for one eye exam and one pair of glasses every year. That's in theory. In practice, the vision care benefits may not be inadequate. You get one pair of glasses from Metro Plus or Child Health Plus or whatever managed Medicaid program you have, and you get your one pair of glasses, you lose your one pair of glasses, too bad, it's out-of-pocket costs. The follow-up exam may be covered, but the glasses may not be. It's very difficult to actually manifest on the ground the insurance coverage to meet the needs of the children. And those out-of-pocket costs, again, if you have a high copay and it's $20 for the pair of glasses, that $20 may just be too high of a barrier. And even with insurance and affordable insurance available to everyone, affordable is a relative term and may not actually be affordable. And there are other host of barriers that I'm sure are other seminars here to discuss. But suffice it to say, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, there are about 6% of children in New York City who are uninsured. And in a city with 1.4 million children, that works out to something like 80,000 children going around without insurance, which is a huge number. So those are my conclusions to leave with for discussion, but I just want to first say thanks actually to my older sister, Ariel, who's here, who's a public health dentist, and and then would thank everyone else at the Crest Vision Program, Barry, Bob, and Phoenix, who run the program, and my mentors there, and also especially to my NYU co-interns who enabled me to be here and not working at Bellevue Hospital today. I'll leave it. I think it's supposed to be a panel of questions. Well, thank you very much.
If all the other speakers could come up here and join us, we'll get about questions. Let's pull up a fourth chair.
I'll go get that.
Thank you. Any questions for any of our panel? Renee? We'll stand. And thank you all. These are terrific presentations. I mean, there was so much overlap here, but it really, I thought, flowed really nicely from one to the other. So thanks. Renee, do you have a question?
No, great presentations past Monday. I feel that. So full disclosure, I'm an optometrist and a pediatric optometrist. I'm part of the intersection. I'm also in school-based care, and our program is called Student Succeed.
Rush to trademark.
I think. I'm going to look at it. No. But, so I actually have questions across the board, and so I have a list of questions, but I'm not going to ask all of them. So I'd like to keep it apart, because we can compare and contrast some of the work that we're doing across the country, and I work out of Michigan. My first is, this is kind of a broad overreaching statement here. I'm very interested in the collaboration that you might have with pediatric optometrists. And one of the major questions I have, for those of you that have screening programs and not comprehensive dilated eye exams, my question is, how did you measure the validity of your screening? For example, a retinomax used by a nurse, an undilated retinomax. Understanding some of the kids that you're missing there. So that's just one part of it, the screening sensitivity and validity. The second question I had on the insurance side of things, I'm very curious. I missed the very first part of the first presentation, so I apologize. And you may have discussed this, but on the insurance side of things, are you billing insurance for services, or for those of you that have free services, if they have insurance, you're not billing it, even if they have it? Is that correct?
No, we don't bill at all. If they do have insurance, that means they have more options in terms of ophthalmologic follow-up. So we'll let them know if there's someone closer to them. Our clinic is in the middle of Manhattan, and so if they want to come to us, it's obviously free, but if they want to go somewhere closer to them and they do have insurance, that gives them an option in their neighborhood.
But you will see them if they have insurance.
Absolutely. So we see people regardless of insurance. The only piece for us where it matters is if they need follow-up ophthalmologic referral. In which case, it just opens more doors for them. It gives them more options. But ultimately, if they want to come to our clinic and see us at Weill Cornell, they're able still to see us free of charge.
So, full disclosure, I'm not from Vision to Learn, so I was an independent evaluator. But I know from their program, they see everybody. They do not bill. However, there has been some advocacy work at the state level, and California is going to do a trial of allowing programs to bill for the children who have Medicaid. It would still be offered at the point, you know, of service, would be free to all families, but the program itself could bill for the children who have Medicaid. And, you know, stay tuned to see if that is successful. Hopefully there will be a move to roll that out further.
And also in City Heights, we see all children free of charge, no billing, but we do give a copy of their prescription directly to the school nurse and to the school-based health centers. School nurses and school-based health centers follow up with their care, especially if it's a school-based health center, where in City Heights it's two FQHCs, federally qualified health care organizations, that work together that cover almost about 98% of our population. So they're seen right where their primary health care provider is located. But we don't charge for this service.
We're not currently billing, so we see kids whether they have insurance or not, but we are planning to bill. We start collecting the information because it's part of making the program sustainable. Mm-hmm. But it does, what he mentioned about, it does come into play when they have a referral, and we have to refer them out to an ophthalmologist, then it's easier for us to get someone in who has insurance. But, you know, we find a way when we have people who work with us have free resources if they don't, but it's more difficult.
Did anyone want to speak to the your collaborations with optometry, pediatric optometrists specifically?
So we work specifically with, we have an optometrist who sees all ages, Barry, who is shown in the picture there. So we don't specifically have a pediatric optometrist, but we do have a pediatric ophthalmologist in the Department of Ophthalmology at Mount Cornell, who will see people, and we work very closely together. And then to answer sort of your question specifically about the Retinomax, our policy is just to not use them on children under 12, because they, you know, will, they accommodate like crazy, and you can actually just see the machine spinning its wheels and not reading anything. And we don't use that measure for those children, but for older kids, we will.
So in reference to that question, I'll defer to Ileana, who's with our UCSD Shiley Eye Center, using the Retromax and its validity.
Yeah, so we do use the handheld autorefractor for all of the screenings. We have found that most of the children are farsighted, especially our preschool children. So when they're doing the distance visual acuity chart, we weren't getting the results we needed. So what we do is we do use a handheld autorefractor. We did tons of lid searches on it, and that's the one that we used. We were using before a photo screening device. What ended up happening is that a lot of the kids are Latino, and the dark pupil did not allow it to dilate correctly. And the handheld autorefractor is a great indicator for astigmatism, which is one of the things primarily in the we do City Heights partnership, but we also see about 15,000 kids every school year in San Diego, in the preschool age, and about 60% of the kids that we see in the last class is with the students.
I really appreciate that response. A lot of our patients are Latino as well, and so I understand the astigmatism. I was asking because of the lack of the paucity of the literature validation about beyond preschoolers and beyond dilated retinomax with preschoolers and using preschooler studies. So that's why I was asking about that. That is my concern, that we miss a lot of those late night girls in the plus 650s that come out to be a plus one, and they can accommodate to 2025, so you'd never touch them with screen. And those are the kids that need.
Yeah, and our screeners, which are both here, also do a year rotation with the optometrist to use the handheld autorefractor, and knowing that when the numbers go up, we're the fingers, so that they don't accommodate as much. So there's different techniques in using that instrument.
Other questions? Kathleen.
Good morning. I have to do full disclosure. I'm a member of the vision section, the school health section, and the public health nursing section.
Yay!
Thank you.
absolutely agree.
Yeah.
My name is Roger from Chandler, and I'm out of Mulch at the University of Rochester. One of the biggest things that we've had when we do some screenings in our eye center is tracking the kids. As you said, you know, at Cornell, you know, they break their glasses, they may get another pair, but, you know, you don't know if they're using them or not. What have you done with the school system to try to track these kids and see how they're doing over the years?
We actually established evaluation component to our program now, and so we are linking with the evaluation units at the school district, particularly Houston Independent School District, and they actually have done some evaluations of the kids who are participating in our project, and they have demonstrated that they are improving. They have shown academic improvement over other kids who did participate in terms of their test scores and their attendance. So we are working through the school districts to actually track the kids over time that are being stay in our program.
We're working with the teachers at each one of the schools, and the school nurse, again, has access to the prescription, which is in her database. So it's in the health information link database. So each year it comes up that child has a prescription, whereas it might not have come up before. And so with that, they are directly working with the teachers. And the teachers are very well aware now that if the child has the glasses, I tell you, there was one case where there was a hot pink pair of glasses, and the teacher said, I have a hot pink pair of glasses, and nobody came to claim them. And it's like, okay, how many hot pink pairs of glasses are there? But now the teachers are very familiar with which children have the visual deficits and which ones need glasses and whether they have a second pair or not.
Yeah. So similarly, we have a follow-up evaluation looking to quantify that effect and have found statistically significant impacts on grades for students who participated in the program. The other thing that sort of came out of the focus groups that I didn't share with you was we talked a lot about ways to improve the program. And teachers told us loud and clear that they wanted to know who in their class needed the glasses and was supposed to wear them. And Vision to Learn has since sort of changed their systems to make that available to teachers and the school nurse. The other thing was that we found that the glasses were actually really highly valued. And so also because of that sort of like peer pressure, kids got their glasses with their friends. We actually found that, you know, about 80 to 85% of kids still had and were wearing their glasses up to like a year later, 6 months to a year later.
Hi, I'm Nancy Prell, and I guess out of disclosure, I'm a director of a school-based vision screening and eye distribution program, and we operate in 6 states, and I'm striving to create a business model to sustain and accessing insurance reimbursement. So I have to ask business questions, and that is, do any of you have price points of the cost per child in screening and eyeglass distributions?
Yeah.
And what it costs to operate your programs?
I would say that when we first started, I think our out-of-pocket cost, and this is not the full cost because we get a lot of donations, probably about 2/3 of what we get is donated. So our out-of-pocket expenses were around $32 to $33 per child.
Yeah. Ours were $35 and then went down to
$26
per child.
And so that's for the full package?
That's looking at all the children, those that were receiving the primary screening and then those that were receiving the secondary screening. So it's the entire.
So I know with Vision to Learn, the cost of their whole program is about $100 per child. The cost of the glasses themselves are $25.
Similarly, Crest screens adults and children. So I know our operating budget annually is something around $400,000 to $500,000 for about 4,500 person screens. So it works out to about $100 and some odd per year. But I don't know what I think the cost per child is actually a bit less because their glasses are less expensive. But that's all told operating costs.
Other questions? I have one question. Some of the work we do at Prevent Blindness, we're with our National Center for Children's Vision and Eye Health, we're looking at state systems and how states can improve data systems, performance measures, et cetera. I'm certainly heartened by the fact that there are these programs in some of the largest cities in some of the largest states, and I wonder if there is any interaction with the state systems and how you think your programs can advance some of that work.
Well, we are beginning to look at how we can work, I think I mentioned earlier, about the legislation that mandates the screening. But we feel that there are some changes that could enhance the program, because the state has been tracking screening for years, but they don't do anything about working with the solution. So there needs to be some link between the screening and then actually seeing that the vision is resolved. Some of it is practice issues, like they require that the school district submit a report to them at the end of the year. By that time it's too late for the kids that year. So maybe if they required it earlier in the year, then that would, get the ball rolling a little earlier, with immunizations, I guess. That is an example. Kids can be, I'm not advocating that they be put out of school, but that, put out for immunization because it's communicable disease, but, there should be some accountability for also resolving the issue. So we're just beginning to look at some of that at the state level, in addition to funding that they could allocate to that.
I think we work very closely with Health and Human Services in our county in San Diego, as well as our county representatives that speak on behalf of us for the state. Get your government involved at the highest level so that they know what you're doing, and we actually have a very wonderful advocate at that level to support. And as we were saying, there are some changes that are happening in the state of California related to vision and funding. Also, in California, we have the local control funding that is and can be utilized for services such as this. And it's a local control funding for kids to succeed. And it's kids in most impoverished areas to succeed. So again, working with school-based health centers, public health nurses, one can certainly look at how that will also change, change the landscape as we move forward.
Other questions? Well, thanks again. This was a terrific panel.